Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau, and I'm your host. You can learn more about who I am and what I do by visiting my website, joyfulvegan.com, and you can check out 30dayveganchallenge.com, where you can sign up for the online program and receive the book at a discount. Today's topic is Animals and the Age of Enlightenment, how thinkers in the 17th century paved the way for animal protection today. Hi, everybody. I hope you're doing fantastically well. It's a beautiful morning here in Northern California. Just enjoying the morning after the rain. We, as you know, are in our fourth year of a drought. And so I welcome the rain, and we're supposed to get more later on. So that's fantastic. Thank you all for listening. I just want to start the show with just a couple comments. One is an email from a listener and one is from iTunes. First, the email. Hi, Colleen. I thought I'd send you my own love note about the profound impact you have on the lives of others and through that, animals everywhere. It's because of you that I can say these aren't my values. They're everyone's values. When I'm attacked for my beliefs being different from everyone else's, I can say, I don't believe they're different. I think we're all compassionate. I learned that from you. Thank you for everything you do. You're changing the world. Thank you, Sierra. That's so meaningful for me. And I am so grateful I can help just articulate what we all feel and think. And here's a comment from iTunes, which I love. It goes, I love this podcast. I'm not vegan, but I will start the 30-day vegan challenge in a few days. I've learned so much I didn't know, and I feel this is what I need to do, not only to be healthier, but to help animals. Just an amazing podcast. Thank you, Lorena. On iTunes, please leave your own comment on iTunes and subscribe, of course, while you're over there. And thanks so much, everybody. I will be in LA next week for a book signing, so I hope you can join me for that. And I just added another event to the appearances calendar. So if you're going to go to the Natural Foods Expo West in March in Los Angeles, I will be there, and I will be there with Follow Your Heart, signing books at their table for a couple days, and just super excited to be with Follow Your Heart. They're going to be releasing their new products and cheeses, which is super exciting, and I hope to see you there. Also, keep in mind that there are a few spots left for the trip to Italy with me. So go to the appearances page at joyfulvegan.com and join us in Italy. And finally, I made a very exciting announcement on my blog at joyfulvegan.com. So I encourage you to go read it. It's called Vegan TV Series Here We Come. But I'll say no more. You will have to read the blog post. So let's get into today's episode, Animals and the Age of Enlightenment. Regular Food for Thought listeners know that I draw upon literature and philosophy and religion and etymology and history and linguistics and anthropology to talk about these very broad topics of compassion and food and ethics. And I truly believe that you cannot understand the present unless you understand the past. Although we individuals here in the 21st century are part of a very long continuum, I think we tend to forget that. I think we get stuck in a myopic mindset where we see only what's in front of us and think that we're significantly different from those who came before us. Now, on one hand, it's interesting because I think we tend to romanticize the past and thus be very cynical about the state of the world in our present day. And on the other hand, we can be incredibly arrogant and superior and think that we're so much more advanced in our thinking and behavior today than they were, right? They is how we would characterize the people in the not so long ago past. And of course, when you spend any time reading history at all, you realize that it's not black and white, that it's not one or the other. The truth is so much more complex and interesting than that. Now, when we look at the history of how we've perceived and treated non-human animals, the same is also true. The past is pretty extensive, right? I mean, that's a very broad time period. So it must be broken down to really get a better understanding of how things have changed for animals and continue to change. I think a lot about what needs to be done to change the world for animals. And I do believe our thinking needs to be changed, and which is what I have devoted my life to, is just really shifting those paradigms. And I can see it happening. And I also believe laws need to change for animals. And that too is happening. Both are slow. And though you can measure the latter, it's a little harder to measure the former. It's harder to measure the mindset of a culture, but you can see the changes reflected in the culture itself, of course, in what people are reading and what they're buying and what they're watching and in what they're eating. But while wishing things could be better than they are, I think sometimes we have a hard time holding the perspective that they're better than they were, because we have to step back in order to gain that perspective. And that's one of the reasons I love history. When you examine history from the dawn of civilization until today, in terms of the data we have, you become aware of the fact that we're still dealing with the same trials and human foibles that we've been dealing with for thousands of years. So I find that very humbling. And you also realize that things do change. And when you look at the arc of history in terms of our treatment of and violence against animals, things are significantly better than they were. No doubt whatsoever. Doesn't mean we don't have work to do. We have a lot of work to do. But things are significantly better than they were. And it's hard to keep that in mind because of our myopic lens and because of what we see in front of us. Things look really bad. But in order to have perspective and hope, we have to step back and view everything from a much higher elevation. And that's what I want to do today, focusing in particular on a time when we can absolutely see the shifts that took place in terms of how we regard and treat animals. And that shift for so many, for human and non-human animals, really started taking place during what is called the Age of Enlightenment or the Age of Reason. And when you examine this time and the thinkers and philosophers and theologians embracing animals, it becomes pretty obvious pretty quickly that no one person had a monopoly on compassion during this time. I am tempted to call it the Age of Compassion. That was kind of my working title for this podcast episode when I first started writing it. But I don't think that was the Age of Compassion. I don't think we're in the Age of Compassion quite yet. I think we have work to do to get there. But this Age of Enlightenment, also called the Age of Reason, as I said, was just that. It really was a time when thoughts started changing and ideas began to be exchanged, and changes really were taking place on so many levels. It was spurred in the 17th century, in the mid-1600s, and it peaked around the end of the 1700s. There's still debate about exactly what time period this encompassed. But the Age of Enlightenment was a very exciting time and a very volatile time during which many revolutions took place, namely the French Revolution and the American Revolution, as citizens began questioning the divine rights of kings as authority and began to find their own voice and fight for freedom and democracy. In that same sense, science and philosophy and reason began to replace a reliance upon religion to explain the mysteries of the universe. The period placed great emphasis upon liberty and democracy and religious tolerance as people began to consider the possibility that freedom and democracy were the fundamental rights of all people, not gifts bestowed upon them by monarchs or popes. And of course, it was prevalent in most European countries. I'm sure you're familiar with many of the names associated with the Enlightenment, David Hume and Adam Smith, Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Francis Bacon, Isaac Newton, and of course in the United States, we had thinkers like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin. Now, this is not an exhaustive list by any stretch of the imagination, but I wanted to just jog your memory about who's who in the Enlightenment. Now, for our purposes, of course, not all of these people were writing about our treatment of non-human animals, but many did have something to say on the subject. And I want to share this with you because I think we tend to forget that some of the foundations on which we stand today as advocates were formed hundreds of years ago. And I find that encouraging and I find it humbling. I have to say, though, that one of the great influential men during the Enlightenment was René Descartes, who, among other things, I mean, he did bring some innovative ideas to the world, and it can't be denied that he was incredibly influential. But he was also a notorious vivisector. At the time, there were no limitations in terms of what people could do to animals in the name of science. Anyone could dissect on live animals or kill healthy animals and experiment on them, from quacks to scientists, and invite the public to watch. And it was not uncommon practice that this happened. Descartes most likely contributed to its popularity, to live dissection, the popularity of live dissection and vivisection. And he probably contributed to people doing whatever horrible things they wanted to animals without compunction, because of his assertion that animals didn't feel pain, that they were not unlike mechanical things. The idea that when they screamed because they were cut, it was not unlike a hinge squeaking you know, if it wasn't oiled. I mean, it was just basically his way of thinking. And certainly when you think that way, of course, you can justify anything you're doing. So it's a convenient way to think to continue justifying what you're doing. But not everyone supported his thinking and behavior. Apparently, he even alienated his own wife because he was experimenting on their own dog. And at the time, there were people who were reacting to Descartes. So among those critics who were reacting to Descartes, specifically in terms of his perception of animals, was Voltaire. So Voltaire was a French philosopher, and he wrote very passionately against animal dissection and vivisection, and he was disgusted by René Descartes' belief that animals were just mere machines and thus incapable of feeling pain. And he writes extensively about it in his Philosophical Dictionary, which I really encourage you to read yourself. I mean, he basically says, that's just horrific. How can you think that way? That's just not even close to reality. That's despicable. And I really encourage you to read his Philosophical Dictionary. It's not unlike Montaigne's book, where we talked about that in another episode, where he just takes on a number of different subjects and provides his thinking about them. Now, like Voltaire, Rousseau also spoke up for animals. In his discourse on inequality, he argued that animals should be part of natural law, not because they're rational, but because they're sentient. And of course, this is an argument that's still used today. He argued that sensitivity, the capacity to experience pleasure and suffering, entitles rights. If you have Vegan's Daily Companion, you'll know that I include a few passages of his, which are really remarkable. I really love reading Rousseau's writings. He was incredibly insightful. And there's one passage in Vegan's Daily Companion that I quote, in which he makes the connection between the consumption of animal-based meat and the propensity for violence. So he was pretty ahead of his time. I say that aware that I don't think that's a common way of thinking even today. And I believe that very strongly, the connection between not only what we're doing to animals and the violence it creates in us, but also just the consumption of all of that fear and violence. So he was writing that probably in the 18th century at that point. He was probably in the mid to late 1700s. But still, I think that's an idea whose time has yet to come. And I'm happy to carry that on. Dr. Samuel Johnson, who's, I adore him, English poet, essayist, ethicist, literary critic, biographer, editor, lexicographer. Of course, he was the author of A Dictionary of the English Language, which wasn't the first dictionary, but it was really one of the great contributions in terms of lexicography and etymology. And he was pretty remarkable, especially being a work from one person, which was pretty ambitious, and he did it. And if you want to see a very funny episode about Samuel Johnson writing the dictionary, you have to watch the Blackadder episode, where it has a Samuel Johnson character writing the dictionary, and Blackadder just kind of messes up the whole thing. It's pretty funny. Anyway, Dr. Samuel Johnson was vehemently opposed to experiments on animals, calling the scientists who performed them a race of wretches. And there are several quotes from him talking about how animal dissection and vivisection harden a person's heart. So more powerful stuff about the connection between, you know, violence against animals and what it does to us. And that was not an uncommon perception, that one of the reasons we shouldn't be cruel to animals is because it makes us violent towards other people. So some people were advocating for animal rights, or at least advocating for reduced violence against animals, because of what that meant for violence toward people. And some were calling for animal rights just on their own merit. So you see different kinds of thinking like you do today. Dr. Johnson, of course, is the subject of one of the most famous biographies called Life of Johnson by James Boswell. And in it, Boswell talks about Johnson's fondness for animals in general and for his cat, Hodge, in particular. And indeed, Hodge is memorialized in a beautiful bronze statue, which was unveiled in 1997 outside Johnson's house in Gough Square, is how I would say it. We have a Gough Street here in San Francisco, G-O-U-G-H in London. And I will indeed have to go find the statue when I return to London, but I've put a photo up of it on the page for this podcast up at joyfulvegan.com. So you can just go check it out. This beautiful bronze statue of Hodge, his cat. I love that. So you've got Isaac Newton also. Isaac Newton, of course, lived from 1642 to 1726. And of course, he's credited with formulating the laws of motion and universal gravitation, plus a million other things, being the greatest scientist who ever lived, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to list all of his credentials here, but he was one of the many distinguished men of his time who praised a vegetable, i.e. non-animal diet. They wouldn't have called it a vegetarian diet then. They wouldn't have called it a vegan diet then. But along with John Milton and Alexander Pope, other men of his time, he really praised eating a vegetable-only diet. He had a deep compassion for animals, and he's credited with saying, "Abstention from cruelty to animals as a moral command is almost on par with love thy neighbor." So he felt really strongly about it. Who knows how long he stayed vegetarian for? We don't know. But he certainly had the inclination toward compassion and vegetarianism. Speaking of Alexander Pope, in his most famous poem, Essay on Man, which he wrote in 1734, he expresses remarkable empathy, depicting animals as being similar to human animals in their feelings of joy, love, pleasure, and pride. And then he chastises humankind for their self-centeredness. So read, I think, you should read it on its own, in its entirety, Essay on Man, but you can certainly read these excerpts as well. So that was Alexander Pope, who was a poet. And at the time, the Age of Enlightenment wasn't really known for its literature. It was really known for its philosophy and science and politics. But certainly there were writers like Alexander Pope who were speaking on behalf of animals. Now, it wasn't just secular folks who spoke up for animals. I think there are a lot of knee-jerk reactions among animal advocates today who make derisive generalizations about religion and animals, but there were and are plenty of religious figures who opposed and oppose animal cruelty and spoke on behalf of compassion. And I'm really excited to share these pretty enlightened thinkers with you, but I want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. Fittingly, as we talk about animal experimentation, we have AAVS, the American Anti-Vivisection Society, to thank for sponsoring this episode. I don't think a lot of people know that there's a laboratory using our taxpayer dollars to conduct research that benefits the meat industry. You may have read about it. It's called the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center, and you may have read about it in a recent New York Times article. Its sole aim is to minimize costs and maximize profits for the meat industry. This New York Times investigation, which is pretty remarkable because it was conducted by the New York Times. It was not conducted by an animal organization. Not that that makes it any less valid, investigations by animal organizations, but from the public's perspective, it was conducted by the New York Times. And it revealed shocking animal cruelty and neglect. And you can read it at aavs.org/meat. The investigation revealed just a number of atrocities. Newborn sheep intentionally left to die in open fields. A young restrained cow, female cow, suffering broken legs while being repeatedly mounted by six bulls. Stalls so small that piglets are crushed. And many, many other abuses. All of which take place because there's no federal law protecting animals used in agriculture research. The Animal Welfare Act specifically excludes cows, pigs, and sheep from coverage when used in agriculture research. Only Congress can stop this horrific animal suffering, and only you can make this happen because you voted for your congresspeople. So please visit aavs.org/meat, where you can find an action alert and a link to the New York Times article. Contact your legislators and ask them, urge them, to amend the Animal Welfare Act so that it protects animals. I want to say this as well, because this morning there was an article in the New York Times as a follow-up to that. There is now a bill in Congress. It was sponsored by, of course, Cory Booker, who's a Democrat from New Jersey, who's been experimenting with a vegan diet. And by the way, I've been in touch with his people. He needs a little push to put something out on Twitter to recommend the 30-Day Vegan Challenge in my work. And I say this sincerely. I've been talking to his staff people, and it would be wonderful if you followed Cory Booker on Twitter. He's wonderful to follow. He is just such a fabulous person, and I have a very soft spot in my heart for him. He was the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, which is where I went to school, and it wasn't far from where I grew up, and he just did amazing things in that city, and now he's doing remarkable things as senator. And he started following me several years ago on Twitter, which was just very exciting. And like I said, we've been in touch. So he's really there to speak for animals, and it's really encouraging. So I'm not surprised that he was one of the sponsors in the Senate. And then, of course, you have the U.S. House representatives sponsoring the bill. Earl Blumenauer, who's a Democrat from Oregon, Mike Fitzpatrick, who's a Republican from Pennsylvania, Vern Buchanan, who's a Republican from Florida, and Louise Slaughter, that irony does not go unnoticed, a Democrat from New York. And the bill is called the AWARE Act, And this bill would close the loophole that excludes cows, pigs, and sheep from the Animal Welfare Act, from the protections under the Animal Welfare Act. So this is a very exciting opportunity to urge your congresspeople to do the right thing. So aavs.org/meet. Thank you also to awesome listener supporters, Tanya Kummer, Susan Gregory, and Carolyn Solerzano. To support this podcast, please go to joyfulvegan.com and either become a monthly contributor with fun perks or make a one-time donation. So as I said, I think it's tempting to lump together all religions over the course of time as not being friends to animals. And of course, we have evidence of many religious leaders and thinkers who were not kind to animals and pushed forward ideas that really contributed to our abuse and violence against animals, no doubt. But it's not the whole truth to say that all religions or all religious figures have been unkind to animals. George Fox, who lived from 1624 to 1691, he was the founder of the Religious Society of Friends, which is commonly known as the Quakers. He abhorred hunting and hawking, which were the outdoor diversions of his time, and he was known to outwardly rebuke people who he witnessed mistreating animals in his presence. But it was George Fox who was the founder of the Quakers. And philosophically speaking, Quakers are opposed to animal cruelty in general. They object to experiments on animals for trivial purposes such as cosmetics. They're divided as to whether animal experimentation should be allowed for medical research, as many people are. Quakers oppose blood sports and do not approve of businesses that exploit animals such as circuses and zoos or the fur trade. One well-known Quaker preacher in the 18th century named John Woolman openly preached against cruelty to animals while he preached against the cruelty of slavery. He wrote, quote, "As by his breath being God, as by his breath, the flame of life was kindled in all animal and sensitive creatures. To say we love God and at the same time exercise cruelty toward the least creature is a contradiction in itself." And here's a lovely bit of trivia. As he grew older, his concern about the treatment of animals grew so much that Woolman avoided riding in stagecoaches, for he believed that the drivers were often too cruel to the teams of horses. Doesn't mean he didn't ride a single horse on his own, but he wouldn't get into stagecoaches because of the cruelty to the horses. So he was mindful, and I think that's beautiful. John Wesley, 1703 to 1791, he's the founder of the Methodists, along with his brother Charles, Charles and John Wesley. And John Wesley also opposed animal cruelty and preached that he believed that non-human animals most likely had souls, would be redeemed in heaven for the ills and cruelties brought upon them on earth, and that children shouldn't be allowed to cause animals harm. And he also stopped eating animals. Here are a couple passages of his remarkable thoughts about animals. Quote, "I believe in my heart that faith in Jesus Christ can and will lead us beyond an exclusive concern for the well-being of other human beings to the broader concern for the well-being of the birds in our backyards, the fish in our rivers, and every living creature on the face of the earth." How beautiful is that? That through his faith, he would find, and this is what he's encouraging and hopeful for in the future, that through faith, we would find a broader circle of compassion to not just include humans, but to also include non-humans. And then he wrote the following to the Bishop of London in 1747, quote, "Thanks be to God, since the time I gave up the use of flesh, meats, and wine, I've been delivered from all physical ills." So that's pretty cool. Anglican theologians also embraced compassion for animals. For example, we've got Humphrey Primett, an Anglican priest, 1736 to 1779. He's the author of A Dissertation on the Duty of Mercy and the Sin of Cruelty to Brute Animals, which is available at Google Books. You can go find it and read it. It's pretty remarkable. And here's a quote from it. Quote, "No creature is so insignificant, but whilst it had life, it has a right to happiness. To deprive it of happiness is injustice, and to put it to unnecessary pain is cruelty. It is very unreasonable, therefore, if not foolish in men, to estimate the degree of the sin of cruelty to any creature by the value we set upon the creature itself, or to suppose that difference in size or difference of beauty are foundations of real difference as to the feelings of brutes." Brutes being his word for animals was a very common word for animals at the time. "A fly has feeling as well as an ox, and a toad has as much right to happiness as a canary bird." How wonderful is that? And what's so lovely about it is that, and you'll find this if you read the entire thing, is that his barometer for our treatment of animals is the very basic fact that they feel pain and suffer, and thus we shouldn't bring suffering upon them. Like, that's just the bottom line. That they feel means that suffering shouldn't be brought upon them. And so that's one of the categories of philosophy around our thoughts and treatment of animals, right? That they have their own basic rights because they have their own, their ends in themselves, right? So that's kind of the basic animal rights philosophy, is that being ends in themselves who want to protect their own lives and their own bodies, they should be granted their own rights. Then you have, because they suffer, because they feel pain, that pain and suffering shouldn't be brought upon them. And then you have the humanists, many humanists of the day, and we see this today, we're against animal cruelty because it meant that you were going to further cruelty to humans. And so these are just different categories, but they're all being thought of at this time and all being kind of worked out and generated, which is really exciting. Also, unlike some humanists of his day that railed against cruelty to animals taking place in the sport of the quote-unquote lower classes, such as bear baiting and cockfighting, his compassion cuts across all classes in that he also attacks the blood sports of the upper classes, such as hunting and hawking. And of course, he wasn't the only one. You want to return to that podcast I did on the 18th century Scottish writer John Oswald, called The Scottish Voice for Compassion, said there were others thinking this way as well. Primit also makes the connection between racism and the exploitation of non-human animals. He wrote, "The white man can have no right, by virtue of his color, to enslave and tyrannize over a black man. For the same reason, a man can have no natural right to abuse and torment a beast." Yeah, he said that long before Alice Walker did. He said that in the mid-1700s. So once again, it's apparent to me that we 21st century advocates do not have the corner on compassion, and I'm grateful for that. The Age of Enlightenment provided the climate in which to exchange ideas and express ideologies, and it was a very exciting time for that reason. And of course, the big question is, does the mere flourishing of ideas push those ideas in a particular direction, right? More specifically, did these thinkers and philosophers and theologians contribute to the improved treatment of animals in practice and not just in theory? Now, I've got my opinion, but I'd love to hear yours. So please go to the show's page at joyfulvegan.com and share your opinion with me and with other listeners. I'd love to see a dialogue take place over there. So thank you again to all of the listener sponsors and to the American Anti-Vivisection Society. I've heard from so many of you who appreciated having something very specific to do for animals in the last year, being urged to talk to your legislators about the Humane Cosmetics Act. And now AAVS is giving you another opportunity. So go to aavs.org/meet and ask your legislators to include farmed animals under the Animal Welfare Act. Don't forget to subscribe to the Food for Thought feed, leave a review on iTunes, and of course, support the podcast if you're able. For the animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. Thanks for listening.